Welcome to the Sharon Hour, just starting on Laguna's KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and tonight my topic is consciousness. What exactly is consciousness? How would you define it, listener? The noted philosopher René Descartes proposed that it was dependent on the ability to think, cogito ergo sum, or je pense donc je suis, in his native language, I think, therefore I am. But we don't really know who thinks, other than inferring that our own species does most of the time. But does a person in a coma think? Or is thought suspended? And if it's suspended, does the I am, the particular and singular human quality of you, go away? In other words, do you continue to exist? Do you stop being human? We can't actually get into each other's thoughts. Or at least not yet anyway, as far as we know for sure. Given the technology hooking itself into our brains, we might, or certainly are on the verge of it. But that's a whole other topic. What I want to explore tonight is how many of us, whether animal, vegetable or mineral, actually have consciousness. What it means to have consciousness, or conscious thought, is. And is the process of thinking unique to us humans? And is it autonomous? Or is it part of a collective? Is it possible for us to think autonomously? Last week I did a show on ants, and we discovered that ants, although they operate like a bunch of human neurons, need a huge mass in order to be able to survive, because it's all coordinated activity. But so it is in our human brains. Still, ants can't exist autonomously as independent individual beings like we can. They can't even exist in small numbers, certainly not in singular numbers. But our own human perceptions as individuals are never exactly singular either. I can't look at you and not see the landscape behind you, the cushion you're sitting on, or the tree in the background. I can't isolate one bit of consciousness from another, and that's just in what I'm literally perceiving. So what's going on in my head and my thought process is vastly more complicated, because I'm not necessarily consciously aware of all the associations my neurons are making, but they're making them within me. So it's weird, right? It's like I also can't exist in a vacuum. I exist on this earth with my body planted somewhere, in a room or on a lawn or in a bed, and that makes me part of my environment and it makes the environment part of me. You might say, so what? These are all philosophical issues, but I think it's fascinating to explore who we are, what consciousness is, whether and how we exist on this earth, and to what end. And in what way we literally function. And since, as I mentioned, my Sharon Hour here on KX935 last week explored the phenomenon of the world of ants, it seems fitting to start my exploration tonight of human life and consciousness with this.
Have you ever spent much time thinking about the fact that you are actually a colony of single-celled creatures? It's kind of freaky, but it's also quite wonderful. You're a society of 100 trillion little creatures, and 90% of them are bacteria, which is kind of embarrassing, but you can't live without them, so collectively they're you. And even the ones that have human genes, they're really just little single-celled animals, and they reproduce asexually. They divide into 2, then 4, then 8, then 16. And almost the only thing that's special about them is the fact that they're covered in glue. So they kind of end up stuck together in a lump instead of swimming off and living happy, independent lives. So basically, you are a lump of sticky little creatures.
Lovely. That said,
we human beings can be quite clever when we try, and over the centuries, we've managed to solve many of the great mysteries of the world of life. We know now that the sky is not really held up by 4 tent poles, and that stars are not really tiny little things, they're just a very long way away. We even know that teenagers are not really possessed by demons, they're just clinically insane. But there are still some mysteries left, the origin of the universe. That's quite a big one. And there's a lot of mysteries about how a tiny little egg cell can grow and develop into something as complex and wonderful and tremendously attractive as you, and there's the mystery of consciousness, the great secret of consciousness. How come there's a me inside my head looking out? So I'd love to talk about all three of those things, but I only have minutes, so I'm just going to solve the secret of consciousness. And I don't want to leave you in suspense, because frankly, when you hear the answer, you're just going to be bitterly disappointed anyway. So I'll tell you the secret straight away, and then I'll try to make you feel better about it. So, okay, here we go. You ready? The great secret of consciousness is... No, actually, I'll tell you a story first. When my son, Christopher, was a little boy, one of his teachers asked him what he wanted to do when he grew up. And Christopher very confidently answered, "I want to study how one thing affects another." And as career plans go, I think his teachers felt that was a little bit vague. But I was really proud of him. For a start, you can never be unemployed with a skill like that, can you? You want to solve the problems of cancer, you want to find out why wars get started, you want to design better spacecraft. Who better to ask than somebody who knows how one thing leads to another? But he was right. You can study how one thing affects another. It's called cybernetics, because there's not that many ways in which one thing can affect another. And if you're quite good at patterns, you start to see that the same kinds of dynamics occur at many, many levels of scale. And what Chris really meant was not how one thing affects another, but how one thing affects the first thing again. So something called circular causality, or feedback. And cybernetics is the study of feedback. And this is really important, because basically everything you see around you exists because of feedback. The atoms in the seat in front of you, the mind and the body of the person sitting in that seat, the words I'm using, all of these things exist because of feedback, because they are self-reinforcing or self-regulating in some way. Because if they weren't, they'd just disappear. So everything is feedback, and feedback is everything.
Feedback is sound and smells and antennae, dependent on what kind of creature you are. Consciousness is something amorphous. It's also the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, with the help of many experts culled together for this Laguna's one and only listener-supported public FM radio station, KX935. Consciousness is something we humans think we alone possess. And yet, in all our thousands of years on this earth, in which we've made many scientific and empirical discoveries, we still can't quite qualify what consciousness is, and that's a problem.
How can we make good judgments about ethical questions like abortion or animal cruelty if we don't know what consciousness is? You can't be cruel to something unless it knows that you're being cruel to it. But how do we know whether it knows? So it's a mess. We don't know what we're talking about. We're stuck. We can't move forward with these problems because we don't know what the secret of consciousness is. Oh, I guess that's me then. So, all right, this time I'll tell you, and you're not going to like it. So, the great secret of consciousness is that there is no secret of consciousness. I'll tell you the bad news first, and then I'll try to convince you that it's actually good news. So I work in a field called artificial life, which basically means using technology to explore biology. And so I spend my days making artificial creatures, sometimes robots, but mostly I make virtual creatures that live inside a computer. The only thing worth knowing about this is that they are also communities, so I don't try to program computers to behave like animals. I try to program computers to behave like brain cells and kidney cells and liver cells, and then I try to find ways to plug them together into systems, into communities that collectively have thoughts and feelings and hopes and dreams. And I really think that now I'm starting to get a glimmer of consciousness out of these creatures. And it's nice to feel that I'm starting to get close to something. But a lot of people don't feel that way about it because these creatures are artificial. They live in a computer. So they can't have a supernatural soul. They can't even have freaky, weird things like quantum mechanics to explain their consciousness or all the other things that we concoct to try to make ourselves feel better about how special we are. They're machines. And if I'm right, therefore, so are we. and nobody wants to be called a machine. You just don't want to tell people that. They don't want to be it. It's not exactly special, and machines wear out. So what do I do? What do you do if it bothers you? Well, all that stuff I was telling you about Christopher and feedback and collections of little cells, that's where the answer lies. If you want to know how to deal with the fact that we are machines, and that's not a bad thing, that's where to look.
There's nothing more you can do. So run if you want to. 'Cause we are machines. We will take the field again, an army of a thousand men. It's time to rise up, we're breaking through. Now that we've been improved, everything has been restored. I'm ready for the art of war. There's nothing more you can do. So you can run if you want to.
Are we really just machines, us humans, no better, no worse? Let's see what you think after listening to tonight's The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935. I'm Sharon James, talking about consciousness tonight and the problem with not being able to know exactly what it is. Qualifying it is one thing, understanding it is another.
Why is consciousness so baffling?
Because it's everything we have. All we are. So when I need to talk about consciousness, like now, I always say, what is it first? So we understand what it is. And it is everything. I define it as what goes away in the evening when you go to sleep and comes back the next morning when you wake up. And sometimes it comes back during the night when you dream. So consciousness is all we experience. And of course, if you eliminate experience from everything else, nothing is left. As far as each of us is concerned. So experience means all the sounds and sights of life. It means all the feelings you might have had, have, will have, all the thoughts, all the wishes. It means yourself, your friends, your country, your place in the world. Everything is an experience. There's nothing but an experience for each of us. So that's consciousness. And if we weren't in a way for sleep and sometimes for anesthesia, we probably wouldn't even know that it is such an extraordinary gift, how else to call it? Meaning, if it weren't there, for each of us, there would be nothing at all. In fact, none of us would exist in a fundamental sense. This consciousness that I have an experience right now is the only thing we are absolutely sure of. When Descartes famously said, I think, therefore I am, he really meant, or at least I would translate it these days, as I am conscious, therefore I am. That's the only thing each of us is sure of. Everything else is an inference. That you are conscious is an inference. I suspect you are because you look like me and you act like me. All I know for sure is my consciousness. So if a philosopher tells me that it's an illusion, I say, well, it's the only illusion there is. Maybe illusion is all we have. Well, it's not an illusion at all. As I said, it's the only thing that is, I like to say, really real. So if you want to call what's real an illusion, it's up to you. But I think we have to stick with the notion that consciousness is the one thing we're absolutely sure about. Now, within that, there is an intriguing phenomenon that was pointed out by Schopenhauer. If you start from consciousness, at some point you realize, and we have realized it quite some time ago, that there is a particular piece in my experience, which is my brain, we now know, that if I touch that, then consciousness itself seems to vanish. So there is this wonderful display, like this jungle in which we are, and this conversation we are having, and I feel my body, and I sort of see things out of my eyes. And all of this, we now have come to believe, depends on something inside my skull, that if I knock it out, sort of everything disappears. So in the great theater of consciousness, of experience, there seems to be one place inside here, which is responsible for the theater itself. That is, of course, what gave rise to the mind-body problem that Descartes put out quite clearly. So how is it that this little piece of furniture in the great assembly of the world inside my skull is responsible for the world itself, the mind-body problem?
So the mind-body problem, as far as I can understand it, is the fact that the mind is something different from the physical brain, which is made up of neurons and physical matter, whereas the mind is something amorphous, the thoughts you have and the beliefs you have and the emotions and sensations. Our consciousness, I guess, is rooted in something physical, those impulses between neurons and other brain matter. But it isn't in itself physical. We may wear our emotions on our sleeve, metaphorically, but we can't literally hold them in our hand the way we can the actual physical brain. At least in a lab, we can hold the brain. Consciousness is the topic of my sharing hour tonight. That's for me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. You're currently listening to the musings in beautifully sonorous tones of neuroscientist Giulio Tononi, talking here with his interviewer about mind-body dualism, or substance dualism, as it's also known.
How can the brain explain the mind? Why is the output of the brain the mind? Many different theories from neuroscientists, most of whom believe that the firing of electrical impulses, the flow of chemicals across synapses between the neurons, maybe gross electrical activities across brain areas, the activities of the neurons themselves, circuitry, whole brain areas. In some sense, consciousness is a product of all of that. That's their assumption, but they never, ever make any progress on what it feels like in terms of the inner experience.
So let me give you a few examples indicating why the problem is hard addressed that way. So we have learned a great deal about this relationship between our brain and our consciousness, no doubt about that, especially in the past 20 years, but even prior to that. But there are many things that remain exceedingly mysterious, and sometimes they are very important also from a practical point of view. I'll give you some examples. There are some patients who look, for all practical purposes, unconscious. They don't move, they don't behave, they have no purposeful activity. And if you're a neurologist, you have to look at them and ask yourself, is there something it is like to be that person? Is there somebody in there who is having experiences of any sort, maybe even pain, or is he hearing something, and so on? And that's not an easy question to answer. So we look inside the brain, we do now a functional MRI, we do EEG recordings, we do all kinds of things in a more and more sophisticated manner to try to figure out what's going on. Is there anybody home in there? If you look carefully, in some cases, for instance, you may find that some parts of the brain, some islands of brain tissue, are still very active in a way which is almost normal. But the rest is like a sea of destruction. There is nothing else, okay? So if you're faced with this person who is not behaving at all for months, clinically it's called vegetative state because we assume there is nobody there, but there is a piece of brain in the cerebral cortex, for instance, is heavily active. Say a piece of brain that has to do with usually sound, perception, and so on. What do you make of it? Should you think that there is nobody there, or there is somebody there who's just perceiving sounds and nothing else? He has experiences, he may hear your voice, but doesn't understand much more than that. Or maybe there is a full consciousness in there. So we can't address this purely by looking what's happening in the brain right now. Let me give you another example. When you have a newborn baby or a preterm baby, we know that the activity in the cerebral cortex is minimal. The fibers among the neurons are still not there. They are not myelinated yet. So the communication is very bad. But there are some parts, like the amygdala, which is usually involved in fear, for instance, that are very active. So what is it like to be a newborn baby? Is it like to be anything at all? Is it utter confusion, as William James would say? Is there purely perception of fear, maybe the fear of having been thrown into this world, not knowing what it means, and that's why the amygdala is active, or there is basically nothing there? Okay, these are questions, again, that you can't answer just by looking at the brain as such. I'll give you a few more examples of this. Take an animal like an octopus. An octopus has a rather big brain with a central ganglion and then several other ganglia, almost as big, in the various arms. Now, what is it like to be an octopus? Is an octopus conscious? Does it have experiences? What kind of experiences? Is there one experience, a centralized one and many peripheral ones? Is there a big one? We don't know that. And you can study the brain of the octopus as much as you want, not that we know much about it, and it's going to be hard to know that.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see. In an octopus's garden in the shade. We would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our head on the seabed in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around because we know we can't be found. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. Shout and swim about the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy and they're safe. We would be so happy, you and me, no one there to tell us what to do. I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you.
So, an octopus's brain is a mighty complicated thing, much more complicated than ours. It's the closest thing we have on this earth to an alien intelligence. Its neurons are all over its body, through its limbs, its suckers, in its optic lobes. But that's its brain. We know nothing about its mind. I'm equating mind with consciousness here, and that's the topic of my share in our tonight on Lagunas KX 935. We're listening to what neuroscientist Giulio Tononi has to tell us about consciousness and what it is exactly. Something maybe easier to voice in words than to understand, because we can study the brain, it's substantial, whereas consciousness isn't.
You will never squeeze the essence of consciousness out of gray matter. You can squeeze it as a sponge as much as you want. You will never get experience flowing out of it, because suddenly there is some special property of the neurons firing at 40 hertz or whatever else that might be that suddenly generates experience. Yeah. And this is why philosophers have rightly pointed out for a long time that this is a very hard problem. In fact, it is so hard that I grant you it is impossible to solve. That right. You cannot solve the problem of consciousness by looking at the brain taking it in your hands and asking yourself, how could this piece of gray matter give rise to the phantasmagory, the colors, and the beauty and the shapes of experience? You will not squeeze it out of that. You need to take a different approach. I think the approach is to go exactly the other way around. So while, you know, in neuroscience, we are trying to find the correlates of consciousness. We are trying to find out what happens in the brain when you perceive this, how does it change when you don't perceive it, how does it change when you perceive something else. This is all very important, of course, in understanding how the brain works. But we can't hope to then extract consciousness from that. So let's take the opposite approach. Let's try to start from consciousness itself. Ask, what is it like to be conscious, to have an experience? Identify its essential properties, and then ask, well, how should physical systems, including the brain, be organized? How should they be arranged in order to be able to account for those properties? I think that is the way to address the mind-body problem.
Julio Tononi, this rather brilliant neuroscientist, goes on to describe all the components of consciousness in terms of consciousness being something we individually experience, an interior, intrinsic thing we're talking about now, using scientific qualifications that get very complicated. But this ultimate component did kind of resonate with me in the realm of how memory and consciousness relate.
There is the axiom of exclusion, that is, every experience is only one, is unique. It includes certain things and exclude others. You are conscious at the moment of the color, the shape, the space, and all of those things. You're not conscious of only parts of them. It's the whole thing. But you're not conscious of more than that. For instance, you're not conscious of the value of your blood pressure right now. So there is one experience, and it flows at a particular time. One experience every 100 milliseconds, 10th of a second. So then the idea here is that a system of mechanisms, which has to be informative, constrain the past and the future, it must be one, it cannot be subdivided into independent components, must be the only one. And what is the only one? Is the one that makes the most of a difference. So if you take a set of elements, you're going to do all these calculations to see what anything does, if it does it above and beyond the parts, and then you say, of all this possible set of elements, of all these possible systems, which one is the one that makes the most difference? And the theory says the one that makes the most difference is the only one that really exists from the inside, from what we call the intrinsic perspective. And so within your brain, for instance, the claim would be that there is a set of neurons right now that, as a system, makes the most of a difference to itself in the past and in the future, and no smaller set of that, those neurons minus a few, and no larger set of that, those neurons plus a few, is equally effective in constraining the past and the future. That's you.
That's you, he says, the very clever neuroscientist Julio Tononi's more explicit theory of cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The presumption there is thinking makes me conscious, thinking makes me human. But do we have to be human to have consciousness? Consciousness, what it is, what it means to be conscious, is the topic of my sharing now tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. We're hearing what various experts, neuroscientists and biologists, have decided is consciousness. They may be able to say what consciousness is, but who can say whether anybody else, other than our individual self, has it?
How do I know that any of you are conscious? How do I know that you're not zombies? How do I know what you're conscious of? We all know that we don't directly access the mental lives of others. We can infer the mental lives of others through what they tell us and through their action, through their behavior. That's the only thing we can do. And because by and large the behavior of all people is similar, and because by and large our brains are very similar that give rise to this behavior, including language, we believe very reasonable that we are all conscious, that we all have inner experiences, although I never can access the conscious sensation of even a very close loved one. Now, this argument can be extended without too much problem to include infants and to include patients that are severely aphasic, that can't talk. Neither one can talk and directly tell us their conscious experience. This argument can be further extended to include animals that are similar to us, particularly mammals, cats, dogs, guinea pigs, mice, sheep, pigs, etc. When my dog comes to me whining, limping, gnawing at her paw, I infer that she's in pain. And physiological measures of pain confirm this. When dogs or any other animals are in distress, their heart rate goes up, just like it goes in us. Their blood pressure goes up. They release stress hormone. They have the same physiology as we do. Squids, octopus, parrots, raven, crows, guinea pigs, they're all capable of highly sophisticated behaviors, behaviors that if we people were to carry them out, we would automatically associate with consciousness. Apes can recognize themselves in a mirror. They know when other apes are looking at them. They can cheat. They can lie. Honeybees can recognize individual faces. They can communicate the quality and the location of a food source to their sister via the waggle dance. They can navigate through complex mazes with the aid of cues that they store in short-term memory. And a scent blown into their hives triggers a return of the honeybees to the source where they previously encountered this odor.
Every honeybee fills with jealousy when they see you are with me. I don't blame them, goodness knows. Honey's on the road. When we're passing by a flower-driven sigh, and I know the reason why. You're much sweeter, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose. Don't buy sugar, you just have to touch my cup. You're my sugar, it's sweet when you stir it up. When I'm taking sips from your tasty lips, the honey valley drips. Your confection, goodness knows, honeysuckle rose.
Read that bees have a system by which they know exactly which flowers they've already pollinated so they don't duplicate their efforts. So is that a consciousness, do we think, among what we consider lesser beings than ourselves? Or do we dismiss it as instinct? Or is it just semantics? Consciousness is the topic of my share in hour tonight. That's with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's one and only KX93.5. We're currently hearing from Christopher Koch in his TED Talk. He is a physicist and a neurobiologist who firmly believes that we are not the only animal on the planet to have consciousness. Bees, it seems, have the same associative memory capabilities as we do, if we choose to think of memory as a component of conscious thought.
The brains of all of these creatures, the biophysics and the biochemistry and the neuroanatomy is also very similar. If you look at the genes, if you look at the proteins, the synapses, the neurons or the neural circuit, they're very similar to things we find in the human brain. In fact, this will surprise many, but neuroanatomists have consistently failed to find something singular, exceptional about the human brain. Even its size is not unique because the brains of whales, dolphins and elephants are bigger, up to 3 or 4 times bigger than the human brain. And in fact, only an expert armed with a microscope, an expert neuroanatomist with a microscope, can distinguish a little bit of human brain from a little bit of monkey or mouse brain. It's all very, very similar. At the hardware level, it's all the same. Now, some people point to language as a kingmaker role for consciousness. Interestingly, this excludes, of course, every species except us as possessing consciousness. It was meant to do that. A species that has this ineradicable desire to come out on the top of any ranking. Charles Darwin, the father of modern biology, set out to learn how far worms acted consciously and the mental powers they possessed. And he concluded, after studying worms for many, many years, particularly their sexual and their feeding behaviors, he concluded that there was no absolute threshold separating lower animals from higher animals and assigning higher mental powers to one but not to the other. So the supposition that only humans are capable of conscious experience, in the absence of any Rubicon, of any clear demarcation line between lower and higher animal, between lower and higher brains, between simple and complex behavior, is really ludicrous, this assumption that we are exceptional. A much more reasonable, a much more rationalist assumption is the one that, for example, we shared with Buddhism, that we are all nature's children, that potentially all multicellular organisms, unless it can be actually proven otherwise, are capable of having some sort of conscious experience. That we can all experience the pains and pleasure, that we can all see the sights and hear the sounds of life.
The oak when it blooms, a fox in the brush, the nod of the wood, the song of a thrush, the wood of the wind, a cliff of fall, a scratch, a lump, it is nothing at all. It's the wind blowing free, it's the end of the slope. It's a beam, it's a void, it's a hunch, it's a hope. And the riverbank talks of the waters of March. It's the end of the strain, it's the joy in your heart. The foot, the ground, the flesh and the bone, the beat of the road, a slingshot stone. A fish, a flesh, a silvery glow, a fight, a bat, the range of a bow, the bed of the well, the end of the line, the dismay in the face. It's a loss, it's a fine, a spear, a spike, a point, a nail, a drip, a drop, the end of the tail. A truckload of bricks in the soft morning light, the shot of a gun in the dead of the night. A mile, a must, a thrust, a bump, it's a curl, it's a rhyme, it's a cold, it's the mumps. The plan of the house, the body in bed, and the car that got stuck, it's the mud, afloat, adrift, a flight, a wing, a hawk, a quail, the promise of spring, and the riverbank talks of the waters of March, it's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart.
Cobra é um pau,
é João,
é José,
é um espinho,
na mão,
é um corte,
no pé,
são as águas de março, fechando o verão, é a promessa de vida no teu coração,
é pau,
é pedra,
é o fim
do caminho,
é um resto
de topo,
é um pouco,
sozinho, é um passo, é uma ponte,
é um sapo, é uma rã,
é um belo horizonte,
é uma febre terçã,
são as águas de março, fechando o verão, é a promessa de vida no teu coração.
Pau,
pedra,
vinho,
peixe, coco,
ovo,
vinho,
água,
hidro,
vida,
ol,
ponte,
morte,
aço,
sol,
são as águas de março, fechando o verão, é a promessa de vida no teu coração.
Life, the flow of life, sounds even better in Portuguese, doesn't it? Love that. Hobim's song, Waters of March. Life in everything that breathes life on this earth in the form of consciousness is my topic on this The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX93.5. We're currently listening to a TED Talk by physicist and neurobiologist Christopher Koch. He's talking about the fact that all creatures, whether great or small, have consciousness. It's just a question of semantics and degree, perhaps.
Presumably, as the size of the brain becomes smaller and becomes less complex, the elemental experiences enjoyed by these creatures becomes less nuanced and more elemental. But even to a worm, it probably feels like something to be alive. And so in the form of panpsychism I'm thinking about, any complex system has experiences. Any complex system, such as us or other forms of life, really have two surfaces. An exterior surface, an objective surface that's accessible to everybody. So you can see me, you can observe my behavior, you can look at my brain, you can poke my brain, etc. But each of these systems also has an interior surface, a private one, an intimate one, that's only knowable to the subject itself. And once that system dissolves or becomes disconnected, these sensations will also disappear. So they're closely associated with an intact system. So what this doctrine really says is that consciousness is something immanent in the universe. It's inherent, particularly in pieces of highly organized matter, that highly organized matter, such as my brain, such as your brain, such as the brains of other creatures, comes with conscious experience. Just like electric charge, for instance, it's an inherent property of certain elementary particles, namely electrons and protons. They come with either minus one or plus one charge. It's a property. It cannot be derived from more elemental property. We've sort of hit rock bottom of reductionism. And so it is with consciousness. That we live in a universe that consists out of space and time and energy, matter. So, for example, when you see me, you have a conscious experience of me, you cannot see me in black and white. The color of my clothes I'm wearing is an integral part of your conscious experience. You cannot separate that. This unity of consciousness is reflected at the neuronal level by a multitude of causal interaction among all the bits and pieces of the brain. And when these causal interactions cease, when they stop, like in deep sleep, in anesthesia, during epileptic seizure, etc., the conscious sensation stops. And we know, because at night in deep sleep, consciousness goes away. I don't experience anything in deep sleep. So to be conscious, you have to be an integrated entity. So you can ask, for example, to what extent is my iPhone or my computer an integrated entity? It has hundreds of pictures, for instance, of my family photos. To the computer, though, at least today's computer, all those pictures is just a random tapestry of zeros and ones. They don't mean anything. The computer doesn't know that there's a person in there, an awkward teenager, that it's the same person who later on in different images appears as a graceful adult. To me, this is meaningful. This is my son, because these things are all cross-linked in my brain and they're linked to things in the physical world, but not to the computer.
So then this would suggest that we can't consider the computer a conscious being, but will it become one at some point? Depends on how we define consciousness. Which is the topic of my Sharon Hour tonight, with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. You're currently listening to neuroscientist Christopher Koch from his TED Talk.
So you take a brain, like my brain or like your brain. Currently it has a conscious experience, but currently it is in a particular state, which meaning some neurons here are firing and over here they're not firing, they're silent. And with this system now, with this brain, you can associate a number called the integrated information. It's measured in bits, and it tells you how integrated the system is, the extent to which the whole is more than the union of its part. The more integrated the system is, the more holistic it is, the more unitary it is, the more it's more than just the sum of its part. And the more you can compute this, the more the system has integrated information. Integrated information sort of denotes the magnitude of consciousness, the quality of consciousness. The fact that if you see red, it feels very different from blue. And colors as a whole feel different from sounds, they feel different from pains. This is what's known as a qualia, the quality of any one conscious experience. You take a brain, it is in a particular state. Associated with this is a shape, a particular geometrical shape in a very high dimensional space. And the theory now says that this shape is what conscious experience is. And the different shapes correspond to different conscious experiences. And the only way you know the world is through this. This is your only reality. This is the quiddity of experience, because you don't experience the outside world. I mean, you're only conscious of states of your brain. And ultimately, this is what experience is. You can think of it like a crystal. The crystal is sort of the light inside your head. It is voice inside your skull. It is the only reality. The dream of the lotus eater, the mindfulness of the meditating monk, the awful pain of a cancer patient, they all feel the way they do because of distinct shapes of different crystals in a trillion-dimensional space. Now, the theory can explain why, for instance, certain parts of the brain are much more closely associated with consciousness, and others are more peripheral players. For instance, the cerebellum. The cerebellum is called the little brain. It's at the back of my brain. It contains roughly 2/3 of all the neurons in my brain. If I lose the cerebellum due to a stroke or due to virus or tumor or something, I will walk like I'm drunk, my speech will slur, I become ataxic, but my consciousness is not impaired.
Ataxic, by the way, I had to look that word up, means loss of control of bodily movements. And it's relevant because we're looking for a definition of consciousness, and which part of the brain basically controls the mind, which, say, is the vessel of consciousness. Consciousness is the topic on my KX935's The Share An Hour tonight. We're currently listening to neuroscientist Christopher Koch explain certain functions of the brain that, let's say, influence consciousness. The cerebellum seems to be the part of our brain that is most related to consciousness, but they found that malfunctions in the cerebellum don't seem to affect our consciousness.
And so we have to have an explanation, and integrated information explains this by the fact that the geometry of these neurons, their wiring is much simpler than the wiring of the cerebral cortex. The theory has also been used to design a device, actually clinical device, to assess the extent to which an anesthetized patient is truly unconscious or not, or to assess the extent to which a severely brain-injured individual, like some of you will remember Terry Schiavo, this individual in a vegetative state is truly unconscious, or whether she has pain and distress but is unable to signal that to her loved ones at the bedside. Now, this theory also quite clearly says not all systems are integrated, not all systems are conscious. So a bunch of isolated neurons in a dish, a heap of sand, a black hole, there are many things in the universe that do not have experience. So it doesn't say that everything is conscious.
Okay, so listen now to what Stephen Lorries has to say in his TED Talk.
I'm supposed as a neurologist to know what I mean when seeing a patient and concluding he's comatose, unconscious, or when he's recovering consciousness. And so I would like to share with you some of our difficulties in quantifying consciousness. So how do we do it? I'd like to have a little experiment here. So you'll be the patient. The first thing we'll do is to reduce the complexity of consciousness to the first component, that's the level of consciousness. So that's quite easy. I will look for scoring your wakefulness, whether you have your eyes wide open. Okay? Those of you who are dozing, I'd stimulate you because wakefulness is necessary, but as we'll see, not sufficient for you to be aware. Now, what I mean by awareness is your external awareness, everything you see and feel and hear right now, and that's going through your senses. And then on top of that, internal awareness, that's that little voice talking to yourself, you thinking about your future, your past, internal awareness. And that is a bit more tricky for us to quantify the content of consciousness. So to assess your awareness, I would check if there's a response to a simple command, like asking each and every one here, raise your right arm. Okay. I'm not sure we could conclude that those who didn't are not aware, right? I think this is very important to emphasize. What we're doing as physicians is trying to quantify awareness, actually looking at motor responsiveness. And our patients in coma often are paralyzed. So a patient in coma, by definition, cannot be awake, and so they will never open the eyes, even if we stimulate them, and hence they're considered unaware. Now, coma will only last for a couple of days to weeks, and some of these patients will show some very bizarre dissociation between wakefulness and awareness. They will awaken, eyes wide open, just as you. They would move and breathe spontaneously, but when all the movements are considered reflexes, we consider they're vegetative. They're in a state of wakeful unawareness. And that's very unusual. We're not used to see people eyes wide open, yes, unconscious. And the big challenge for us is to identify as soon as possible those small, minimal signs of consciousness. And they can be very minimal, and you get them now, and they're gone a couple of hours later. So this is really a problem. And those patients with chronic disorders of consciousness, in contrast to coma, they can stay in this condition without any possibility of communication for years, for decades. And I'm afraid that medicine and society has been neglecting these artifacts of modern medicine. So let me share some three, actually, clinical realities, extraordinary realities. And the first one are those patients who, after a severe brain damage, that can be a trauma or a cardiac arrest, are in coma and then evolve to brain death. That is when all brain function is gone. So here, I think it's important we use these new technologies where we inject a sugar, a radioactively labeled glucose. It goes into the brain that uses a lot of energy. So in your brain right now, I hope, there should be a lot of activity in your gray matter, in your cortex, those billions of neurons using a lot of sugar. In brain death, we see the empty skull sign. There's only the skin surrounding the skull that is still using some energy, but not in those billions of neurons. Here, you can safely donate your organs. Because, yes, we do have scientific evidence that there's life after death. It is called organ donation. And it's very important. Physicians are very transparent about that. And we're not used to see somebody in intensive care. The heart is beating, they feel warm, breathing through the machine. And when the brain is dead, your death, I think, is a very important and extraordinary clinical reality. Another one I would like to briefly touch upon are those patients who survive their coma. And they would tell us afterwards that they had this extraordinary experience. They left their own body, they saw a light, saw their relatives, they felt good. These near-death experiences. And again, I think that science and medicine has neglected this reality for far too long. I think science should study this phenomenon scientifically. The third extraordinary clinical reality are indeed these patients who survive their coma, awaken, yet remain unaware. These patients, in so-called vegetative state, unresponsive wakefulness, where with brain scans we can show that there is a very abnormal brain activity, less than half of values we see in normal consciousness. One of our important discoveries, I think, is that for those patients who recovered from this condition, from a vegetative state, we were able to do this study again. And what we saw is not that the brain resumes a normal activity all over, it just recovered in some specific parts of the brain. In other words, you don't need your whole brain to be aware. And I think this is very important to be able to identify the critical brain network. And it's not a small consciousness region, it's a network. It's the external awareness network, both sides in the front and the back, and then the midline, front and back again, this internal awareness network. It's important that these networks communicate with each other, that they interact within and between each other. Now you could say, why would this matter? Well, I think there's maybe three reasons. First of all, it does matter whether a patient is fully unconscious or whether there is a little bit of consciousness. For example, for our treatment of pain. Again, we can use these new machines, neuroimaging tools, to go and look what's happening in your brain when you feel pain. It's not a small spot, it's a network. When you look at brain death, no activity whatsoever. No brain, no pain. Patients who are surviving their coma evolve to this bizarre dissociation of vegetative state, wakeful unawareness, they will activate their brainstem. This is deep in the brain, important for wakefulness, and also a bit of their cortex, but it's the sensory cortex. It's like a slave system. It's isolated, it's disconnected from this awareness network, and so not enough for you to have a conscious experience. And I think it's very important that we observe that those patients with very small signs of consciousness, like following with their eyes or sometimes responding to a command, showed the whole pain network that activated. In other words, these patients can't, by definition, communicate that they would feel any pain, but their brain scans tell us we should systematically treat for pain. Well, this brings me to the next important issue of trying to give these patients a voice, trying to use these technologies to establish a communication. So this patient was sent to Liège with this label vegetative, put him in the fMRI scanner, and we see this activation when we ask a question. It's a very damaged brain, so there's a lot of fluid actually taking the place of the brain. There's, at some places, very little brain left. Again, you don't need a lot of brain to be conscious. So these new imaging technologies permit us to better assess the chances of recovery. And when we measure this in patients with a severe brain trauma or after a cardiac arrest, we can use that information to predict the outcome and to make the right decisions when there's no chance of recovery, when we should increase all our efforts. And that's, of course, a very important life or death decision where these measurements, I think, will help us in the future. In sum, I think that the study of coma and related conditions has permitted us to identify the critical brain networks for awareness. And it's my hope that as an integrated international scientific effort, we'll use that information and we'll continue to increase our understanding of the mystery of consciousness, and then use that knowledge to improve our care for these very vulnerable patients with chronic disorders of consciousness after severe brain damage.
So just a couple of final words then on this rather complex topic of consciousness that was the basis of my sharing now tonight on KX935. First, from the Nobel Prize winner, Gerald Edelman.
The human need to make sense of the story is something that I have observed as a doctor when patients are subjected to serious disease and possibly even dying, because then the question comes up, well, what's it all about, right? Human beings rely enormously on narrative structure to make sense out of things. And not to be able to make sense of your own life story is an extremely distressing thing, and it probably is one of the motivations for religious belief. So there is an issue here, namely the need of human beings to have some kind of belief, and that belief that transcends any evidence, credo quia absurdum, however absurd I believe, if you take it to the human mind, do you really think that knowledge will change the basics of how we are, given the rate of evolution? I think probably not.
You know the biblical creation story. Basically, God created the universe perfect and fully formed, and then some people came along and screwed it all up, and it's all been downhill ever since. That creation story is all about decline and decay. But in my field, complexity studies, complexity theory, we can offer a different kind of creation story. And in that story, the universe wasn't created fully formed and perfect. It was very, very simple and very, 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 very boring. But it's a creative universe, a self-organizing universe, a universe that discovers and invents things that didn't exist before all the time. And so, essentially, thanks to the power of feedback, an empty universe once discovered how to make matter out of empty space. And once it had figured out how to make matter and the matter cooled down enough, it discovered it could do chemistry with it. And the chemistry practiced and practiced and practiced for billions of years and eventually figured out it could make life. And then as soon as life showed up, it was never going to go away again. So it experimented with different ways of plugging cells together into communities to do different things that enabled it to survive, made it self-sustaining. And during that process, eventually, it needed to build models of the world so that it could make plans and predict things. And I think that's where consciousness came from. So it's just what happens when a certain kind of machine is working. There's nothing freaky about it. But this is a pretty cool universe because we emerged out of all this. So what I'm saying is that yes, we are machines, but we're not just machines. We're amazing machines. We're the product of 14 billion years of experiment by an incredibly creative universe.
That may, in hopefully our millions more years to come, uncover the mystery of consciousness. Well, that's all we have time for on the Share Now tonight. Stay tuned to KX935 for emergency alerts and a whole host of other shows. If you want to hear this show again on consciousness, you can do so on iTunes or go to kx935/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. I'm Sharon James. Hoping you'll come back and listen to the Sharon Hour again, either live if you live in Laguna Beach or via podcast.